This public radio podcast is supported by Double Take Gallery, now showing works by Salvador Dali, Norman Rockwell, and many local artists, located in the Southern Lights Building in Burnsville, and online at doubletakegallery.com.
This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. This hour, journalist Bill Moyers with us for the hour. In a year when Americans are voting in unprecedented numbers, when young people are finding the election process relevant again, and when even the television ratings are up thanks to the campaign, Mr. Moyers is worried about our democracy. He writes in the introduction to his new book, "We've fallen under the spell of force, money, terror, and fear." And he fleshes out his arguments in a collection of speeches, reflections, even eulogies that he's given over the years to a Peace Corps audience gathered to commemorate the death of JFK in 1988. He reminds them of what Kennedy understood about empowerment and selflessness. To an audience of educators in 2006, he says, "Make sure your kids learn algebra, biology, and calculus, but teach them about the American Revolution, that it isn't just about white men in powdered wigs carrying muskets and a long time gone." And to the National Conference for Media Reform, he gives his candid, unflinching account of the battle between power and a free press inside the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Bill Moyers writes in the closing paragraph of his introduction, "I'm grateful to the audiences that heard me out. Every one of them blessed my effort and sent me away, believing that the grave diggers of democracy will not have the last word." The book is titled Moyers on Democracy, and he joins me this morning from New York. This is a real pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us.
And it's a pleasure to me too, Carrie. How are you?
I'm good. Who are the grave diggers of democracy?
They're the people who believe that money should rule. They're the people who believe that inequality is good for the country, that it creates great wealth, and that then boosts all the boats when it in fact doesn't. They're the people who believe that we can sustain empire abroad, that we can start a war in Iraq and not finish it. They're all the people who take for granted the assumptions of democracy, but do very little to make democracy work. You mentioned this enormous turnout that we've seen in the primaries in the last several weeks and months. That's very encouraging because people remain hopeful. I mean, the American people are not pessimists by nature, and they keep hoping that an election will actually give us a new start, give us a new day in democracy, when in fact what they usually discover 6 months after the election is that the people who are in charge are the donors who gave the money to the candidates, not the voters who sent the candidates to office. They're the grave diggers.
I wonder if you think Americans in some way hit a tipping point, though, with income inequity, the imbalances of power that you've been talking about in these speeches that are collected in the book, you know, the political impotence that a number of Americans feel. Do you think in some ways Americans reach the "we've had enough and we're not going to take it anymore" point? And that's part of what we see in the turnout during this campaign.
Some people have. I mean, as I say in the book, democracy in America is a story of narrow escapes. We may be running out of luck. I mean, we've always had difficult times in this country. The Civil War, the fight for to end slavery, the Reconstruction, World War II, the Cold War, Vietnam. But we've always assumed progress. That is, that the present is, quote, better than the past and the future will be better than the present. We keep telling ourselves that the system works. But right now, the system is not addressing the deep structural problems we face as a society. Our rising debt, endless war, growing inequality, as you mentioned, the failure of many of our public schools to turn out young people able to deal with the current challenges. We're just not going deep into solving. We're skating on the surface, talking about democracy, but not really making it work for everyone, and that to me is a profound challenge in this country.
How much of that, though, do you think is due to the lack of imagination of our leaders, and how much of it is due to, you know, ambivalence about making the kind of changes that would be required, making the kind of sacrifices to make the kinds of changes that would be required? I mean, you know, Americans, as you say, are a group of people that like to talk. But what about when it gets down to brass tacks and we have to pay higher taxes for a better health care system? Questions like that.
Well, the problem is that we are paying taxes for a system that is not investing that our taxes wisely. I mean, I was coming down here to the studio in a cab this morning, and we hit a terrific pothole. It just tore the tire off the car. In fact, I had to get another cab because and the driver said, you know, how's the mayor spending our money? But he's not spending it on these potholes. I mean, there is this sense that that government is creating, politics is creating these problems that we are not solving. Part of it is due to the lack of imagination of candidates and officials who talk well before the election and then don't govern well after the election. Part of it is due to the fact that Americans are so busy, two income earners in every family, everybody going in every which way, that we can't pay attention, as Paul Wellstone used to say, to the basic cells of democracy, what we can do at home. The only answer to the power of organized money is the power of organized people. And it's very difficult for Americans to organize in a sustained way to challenge the bastions of power that prevail even despite what happens in an election.
I want to talk about money in campaigns here, but as I hear you talk about this, I think of the complaining that's going on right now about the price of gasoline. Now, if you asked Americans in some kind of polling whether they thought higher, you know, gas prices might mean that we use less and that's better for the climate and, you know, all of the consequences that follow from that, Americans would probably say, yes, I'm willing to pay higher prices for a gallon of gasoline if I'm aware that those are the results of it. But what you get out there is, you know, massive griping about how much we're paying for a gallon of gasoline. It seems like when it really comes down to it, we're not that willing to ante up for the change.
Well, griping is an old American tradition, and in fact, it's part of what makes this an interesting country, is that we do feel that we can not only complain about the captain on the bridge of the ship, but that we can go up on the bridge of the ship, grab him by the elbow, and say, that's an iceberg out there, better turn this ship around. It's the First Amendment at work here. There is a lot of griping. All of us can complain. But the problem is structural again. I think economics drives behavior, and we're going to be paying $4 to $5 a gallon for gas. When I was in studying as a graduate student in Scotland 50 years ago, believe it or not, they were paying $3 a gallon for gasoline over there, and we were paying 25 cents here at home. There's no way to avoid the high price of gasoline when you have this growing demand in the world, and when it's under the control of cartels, essentially like OPEC and others. But you know, there are ways that we can deal with it by beginning to move toward alternative energy sources, beginning to move to smaller cars with higher mileage per gallon, beginning to invest in mass transit. I saw a story the other day that mass transit the use of mass transit is higher across the country, is higher than it's ever been. In fact, the problem is we don't have enough mass transit. I think one of the long-range answers to your question is that your generation, the next 50 years, is going to be spending a lot of money on investing in the infrastructure, in railroads and subways and bus systems. So the griping will go on, but it will become ad nauseum unless we begin collectively and individually to find solutions to it.
Let's talk about the influence of money on politics, because this is a recurring theme in the speeches that you've collected here in the book. You said in a lecture that you gave in California a couple of years ago, money is choking democracy to death, and you call the public officials that are often beholden to the money that's raised, the people that are raising it, you call them mercenaries. What about a campaign like Senator Obama's, where he will say, look, 90%, now he's raised massive amounts of money, but he will say that the massive majority of that money is coming in small amounts and from average Americans. Does that remove the danger of so much money coming into the political process?
It's encouraging. It's encouraging to see the internet become a kind of democracy of donors, so that $25 here and $25 there and $25 from everywhere add up to an alternative to the candidates who go around meeting privately with small groups of donors and making assurances to them that their interests will not be threatened. No, this is a promising sign. And I believe just like mass transit is an answer to the woes of a fuel-based economy, democratized fundraising over the Internet is a long-term solution to the grip that, that big money has on politics. But we'll have to see. Senator Obama has a lot of contributors who come out of the Wall Street, the hedge fund, the private equity interest. They're going to be very influential when he wins. I mean, that's the basic problem right now, Kerry, is that there are too many powerful vested interests that have a stake in the dysfunction of democracy. I mean, take, for example, the health insurance industry, $2 trillion spent a year on health care. But as long as much of that money is going to profits, corporate profits, big salaries for executives, big returns for investors, they have a stake in making sure that we don't go to universal health care where the profit is considered secondary to the welfare of the patient. So I'm encouraged by Senator Obama's ability to raise a lot of money from a small amounts of money from a lot of people. But I still know just from experience and observation as a journalist that come January, the big contributors, the bundlers from Wall Street, big corporations, are going to get invited into the discussion much sooner than all those small donors. I mean, I say in the book, and I'm very impressed that you've read the book. It's encouraging.
Of course, I've read the book.
Well, I know, but I mean, it's just good to see you go to these particular kinds of questions. If as I say in the book, if a baseball player stepping up to the home plate were to lean over and hand the umpire a wad of bills before he called the pitch, we'd call that a bribe. But when this industry or that industry, big pharma or the oil industry, buys influence with the people in power, we call that a campaign contribution. And a lot of small donations can, over time, erode their power. But I worry about the paralysis that has set in before that happens.
How well do you think the media covers the money in politics beat?
Not very well, quite frankly. I mean, I hear so many discussions on television between this is a bad bill or that's a bad bill or a good bill, but hardly anyone ever says, you know, who's paying for that bill? Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is the media doesn't go very deeply below the surface into examining what money buys. I mean, we pay at the grocery store because Congress has done sweetheart deals for major campaign contributors. The price of milk goes up because of a special subsidy for area dairy farmers passed by Congress. A 5-pound bag of sugar costs 50 cents more than it should because year in and year out, the sugar lobby persuades Congress to keep sugar price supports alive. And when you go and buy a brand name drug that isn't available as a generic, it's because the drug industry has two lobbyists in Washington for every member of Congress. Kerry, the folks there in Minnesota who want to go across to Canada to buy the same drugs at lower price, they're committing a federal law. They're violating a federal law because the big drug industry got Congress to pass a bill saying that it's a violation of federal law if you go across the border to buy your drugs cheaper. That's just wrong, but it's a direct consequence of money's ability to influence policy no matter who wins the election.
Bill Moyers is on the line with us this morning. We're talking about a new book, Moyers on Democracy, a collection of speeches that he's given over the years, some eulogies mixed in, some reflections on the themes at the center of those speeches. And we're talking about some of the specific issues that come up in those speeches and how they comment, what they say about the state of our democracy this morning. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-242-2828. If you're listening in the metro area, 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, minnesotapublicradio.org, click on Send a Question. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Online with us at minnesotapublicradio.org. Click on Send a Question to Cheryl in Plymouth. Hi, Cheryl. Thanks for being patient and waiting. Your question.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
Another great show, and thank you, Mr. Moyers, for everything you've done in journalism. My question is, as a voter, what are we supposed to do if the problem is in the establishment and they have all the money and all the power? They offer up the candidates that we can vote for. So a lot of times we go to the voting booth and choose the lesser of two evils. So how do we turn the ship around?
Well, that's you're exactly right, Cheryl. That's the way the system works. The two-party system controls the rules. I don't know an alternative to that at the moment, although I think in time going to proportional representation will bring more people into the process than we have with just two parties, so that if a third party wins a certain percentage of the votes in an election, they're represented in the state legislature. There in Minnesota or in the Capitol. But that's not going to happen soon enough. The answer is not to quit on Election Day. I said earlier that the only antidote to the power of big money is the power of organized people. So that we tend to vote and think that's the end of the process. Democracy is not just about voting. It's about organizing, sustaining with collaborators, with like-minded people, with kindred spirits who care. As you do about clean politics, clean money, good governance, to organize and sustain it. And that's the challenge we face in democracy today, that it's one thing to go and stand in the line and vote. It's another thing then to get involved and stay involved in your environmental group, in your clean money campaign, the campaign that's going on around the country to fund elections with public funds. I mean, you have to find a group of like-minded people and stick to it over time and keep the pressure on the people you have sent to Washington or to St. Paul to represent you.
Online here from Mark in Hastings, are you at all heartened by the fact that a dynastic couple like the Clintons can be denied the nomination? Mark says maybe the system isn't fixed after all.
Well, it's not fixed, but it's biased. And this is the point of Moyers on Democracy, the book. It is biased. It leans toward the people of privilege who have the money and the time to spend on making sure that what they want from the political agenda is on the is at the top of the priority of people who are running the country or running the state. The system is set within rules that the two parties determine, but there come moments of fresh and original impetus from people, and I find that encouraging. I'm not a pessimist in the long run. I mean, I said to a friend of mine on Wall Street not long ago, "How do you feel about the market?" And he said, "Well, I'm optimistic." And I said, "Well, if you're optimistic, why do you look so worried?" He said, "I'm not sure my pessimism is justified." I'm the same way. But the fact that, you know, I like an open process. It's good that I mean, I admire Mrs. Clinton in so many ways. It's very difficult in our country for the wife of anyone to achieve the kind of independent profile that a male politician has been able to achieve. She's done a very good job at that. There are things about her campaign that have concerned me as a journalist and as a citizen, but that's true of every candidate. I do think there's a large number of people in this country who are worried about the fact that the two families would have governed America for such an extended period of time, were she to succeed and then be reelected. And you know, I still believe, despite the power of money and meritocracy, I do believe that our democratic process, just about the time where the train's hitting us, you know, perils of Pauline, that something happens to save us. So I think it's a good thing that you've had real competition this year in the Democratic Party.
I want to ask you about another issue that came up during the campaign, and that's Jeremiah Wright. I watched your interview with him over the last couple of weeks, and we had Dr. Martin Marty in the studio just a couple of days after you did that interview with Reverend Wright. And I'd like you to hear what Dr. Marty had to say about what he saw on your program and then on Reverend Wright's appearance at the press club. Here's Martin Marty.
I think that it came across not as that preacher that I've admired in his own church, but on the national stage it came across as a celebrity spotlight and egotistic and arrogant. All those words are there. I wish I didn't have to say that. In my article about him, I had said he has an abrasive edge, and I listed the three or four things that in 45 years that I've known him, I disagreed with. I didn't like his identification with Minister Farrakhan. I think the HIV-AIDS thing was wrong for him to say that. It is not true. It's urban myth. More than half of American blacks believe it's true, but he could have used his position to change it. So I think it's my job, if I'm going to be an honest reporter and believer, to separate the two. Because if it gets harder to talk about because of it, then we don't get where you, Jane, and I would like to take things and where his career until recently had taken him and his parishioner was trying to take us.
Bill Moyers, tell me how what you hear Dr. Marty saying there fits into your conversation with Jeremiah Wright and then some of the things that he said at the press club a day or so later.
Full disclosure, Martin Marty is one of my closest, dearest friends and a man who has taught me for 40 years about religion and democracy and just about what it means to be a good human being. We are very close friends. I talked to Marty before I did my interview Jeremiah Wright, and I read that marvelous piece he wrote in the Chronicle of Higher Education about Jeremiah Wright before Jeremiah Wright went to the National Press Club. I am not a defender of nor an apologist for the people who appear on my show. I try to explain the why of what they – I try to understand the why of what they say, even though I can never really be sure. All of us are you know, many different people. Yeah, each of us has sides of our persona that others won't see. What seems to have happened is this, in my judgment. Jeremiah Wright is a man – who lived a relatively private, quiet life. He had spent 36 years pastoring this church. He had never been on the national scene, as far as I knew. I had never heard of him until all of this broke. He's like the man who goes to the door one morning at his house and goes out to pick up the newspaper and a cyclone hits. You know, I just think he walked out there not really understanding how things had changed, because one of the people who sat in his pew was now a leading contender for the presidency. You know, Jeremiah Wright hadn't been out there organizing the Christian Coalition. He hadn't been out there organizing Moral Majority or Focus on the Family. That is, he felt called to be a pastor. That's where he spent his life. All of a sudden, after 36 years of preaching to the same congregation, building it from 87 members to over 6,000 members, his whole life and ministry are reduced to 16 to 20 seconds of endless sound bites recycled through the mainstream and partisan media. That would have made me angry. It would have made me uptight. It would have perplexed me to have spent, and somebody calculated that over 36 years in the 11 o'clock service on Sunday mornings at Trinity United Church of Christ, he preached 207,311 minutes. And out of those 207,311 minutes, partisans and journalists had selected those 15 to 60 seconds. The man whom I had for an hour on my broadcast was the same man that we saw 3 days later at the National Press Club, but in a different state of mind, in a different frame of mind. I can't explain the difference. I'm not a psychologist. I'm a journalist. Thousands of people have written me to say, how do you, Moyers, explain that a man who was so reasonable in conversation on Friday night becomes so angry in public on Monday morning? I don't know. Only Jeremiah Wright can answer that. I do know that while he made some absurd remarks, as Marty said, about HIV, some of his comments taken out of context did not get a fair hearing. I mean, his comment about the chickens coming home to roost, he was quoting somebody else. He was talking about 9/11. He wasn't saying, as Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell said, that God had caused 9/11 or permitted 9/11 to happen. He was saying, not a simple statement, but he was saying that America's actions in the world have created resentments and backlashes that have consequences. That got totally taken out of context. His views on Minister Farrakhan, of course, I don't agree with them. Minister Farrakhan has made anti-Semitic comments in the past that are repulsive. However, I do know that they live in the same territory, the same neighborhood in South Chicago. They are collaborative rivals. That is, they both are trying to reach large constituencies of underprivileged African Americans. They both want the allegiance of those African Americans, and they can't can't offend each other in trying to serve that constituency. All I'm saying there is that they live in the same block in a way. And you can't be you've got to tiptoe around each other, even though you may have disagreements with each other. I think that we've seen Jeremiah Wright for the last time. He was thrust onto the national scene, for which he wasn't prepared to deal with these batteries of reporters or this constant distortions, and he had his say. He seems at moments to have been extremely distraught or angry. Or even out of control, but I think I can understand that without condoning it, and I think he's gone home now to nurse his wounds, and we probably won't hear from him again. But one final point, Carrie, and that is there was a significant effort by the national media to conflate Jeremiah Wright and Barack Obama, to hold the man in the pew who is running for president responsible for the opinions of the man in the pulpit who is not running for president. That's an old technique in America, guilt by association. I must say, it's been very encouraging the last few weeks to see that despite that cyclonic effort to conflate the two, to take Obama down because of Jeremiah Wright's brief and unfortunate appearance on the stage, a singing off note, that's essentially failed. That the voters in Indiana, the voters in North Carolina, were not totally bewitched by it or fooled by it, and the fact that I think this is one of the most perilous moments in American politics I've ever seen for any candidate, and I actually thought Obama would be hurt more from it than he seemed to have been in Indiana, North Carolina. And that's a tribute to the intelligence of many voters who sit down and say, wait a minute, Jeremiah Wright is not Barack Obama.
I have to take a break for news, but you asked Jeremiah Wright a question in that interview that I want to come back to here on the other side of the break, which was why so many Americans don't want to acknowledge that a nation can be capable of greatness and cruelty at the same time. And when we come back, I'm going to ask you if you'll answer that question as well. Bill Moyers is with us. We're talking about his newest book, Moyers on Democracy. He's with us this morning from New York. A break for news. And when we come back, more of your calls and your questions. 800-242-2828. If you're listening in the metro area, 651-227-6000. If you're online this morning, minnesotapublicradio.org. Click on Send a Question. Back in just a moment to the newsroom. And Perry Finelli. Hi, Perry.
Gary, the death toll in one county alone from a massive earthquake in central China is estimated at anywhere from 3,000 to 5,000 people. Chinese state media report nearly 900 students are trapped after their school collapsed from the 7.8 magnitude quake. Rumbling has been felt as far away as Pakistan, Vietnam, and Thailand. The mid-Atlantic is being battered by heavy rain and strong winds that have knocked out power to thousands and prompted evacuations due to flooding in suburban Washington, D.C. A sinkhole up to 30 feet wide and 10 feet deep has forced the evacuation of three homes. Missouri's governor will tour areas of that state ravaged by tornadoes over the weekend. Among the 22 people killed in three states is a Missouri family of five who died when their car was thrown more than 100 yards from a rural road into a nearby field. A family of four was killed when a tree hit their mobile home. High winds and dry conditions are expected to fuel wildfires in central Florida today. The fires have torched thousands of acres and forced the evacuation of hundreds of homes. Cyclone relief aid from the U.S. is finally making its way into Myanmar. The country's military government is welcoming U.S. help more than a week after that storm. One shipment of supplies arrived today, two more deliveries tomorrow. The National Transportation Safety Board said today it has an investigator on the scene of a fatal medical helicopter crash in the town of Onalaska, Wisconsin. The work now begins to determine what caused the crash of a UW hospital med flight late Saturday that killed all three on board, including the pilot, a nurse, and a doctor. A synchronized community bell ringing and speech by Governor Tim Pawlenty are taking place this morning in Bemidji as part of Statehood Week. Minnesota's sesquicentennial celebration features five so-called capitals for a day, and Bemidji is the first in the spotlight. High temperatures around the state today. In southern Minnesota, around 70s, just the mid-50s in the north, and just the 40s near Lake Superior. Right now in the Twin Cities, 51 degrees, mostly sunny skies. It's 9:35. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Kathy Werzer. We are the hosts of Morning Edition on Minnesota Public Radio, and our job is to help you prepare for the day ahead. We'll let you know what's happening around the world and in your neighborhood. We'll bring you the latest news about the climate and the conflicts, the politics and the arts. Listen weekday mornings from 4 to 9 right here on Minnesota Public Radio News.
Support for this program comes from WCCO 4 News. Tonight, Dennis Doda is curious about how healthy sport and energy drinks are and wonders if they do what they say they do. On Channel 4, tonight at 10.
Programming is supported by McAllister College, welcoming commencement speaker, actor-director Peter Berg, congratulating the class of 2008 for their accomplishments, contributions to McAllister, and their desire to make a difference. McAllister.edu.
We're back on Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I am Carrie Miller. Coming up at 10 o'clock, we're talking about the GI Bill that's under discussion in Congress, getting some pushback from some interesting places and with some interesting arguments. The Pentagon, the White House saying they do not support the current GI Bill. They're concerned that the generous educational benefits will encourage more soldiers to get out of the service sooner than they might have. We'll talk about that. At 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, we're talking about the influence of money on politics and whether how money's being raised during the campaign will change what happens in the way that government gets done. That's tomorrow morning at 9. I hope you'll listen in for that. Back to our conversation this hour with Bill Moyers, out with a new book, Moyers on Democracy. It's a collection of speeches, some eulogies that he's given, some reflections on the state of our democracy. Bill Moyers, you said you were reluctant to have this collected into a book because you thought, what, speeches were better heard than read?
Yes. The editor at Doubleday, Gerald Howard, had heard many of my speeches on the Internet over the past few years. They've been pretty widely circulated. And he called me up and said, these speeches should be put between hardcover. And I said to him, a speech, it's a little bit like radio, Carrie, a speech is such an intimate discourse between the live audience in the hall, which I love, as you like a live audience, and the speaker, and that I didn't think speeches would read that well in print. They're meant for the ear, not for the eye. But he prevailed, and in fact, I'm pleased with it. There's also 10 or 12 of the actual recordings of the speeches, and I've been getting really good letters from people who want to carry on the conversation, and that's what a good speech does, and that's what a good essay does. I'm actually glad to have them. And you know, I get criticized a lot because people hear only my sound bites that are picked up by right wing pundits and shot back at me like errors. It's very good to have your ideas seen in the context. I mean, if you printed Jeremiah Wright's sermons and just highlighted the one line or two lines that had been picked out by his adversaries and critics, you'd have seen there was a wholly different context to them. And that's what this collection of speeches and essays. You mentioned some were eulogies. One of my favorites in the book is the eulogy I delivered for Lady Bird Johnson at her funeral. But the other one that I worked really hard on when I came out to Minneapolis to deliver it is the speech I made in Minneapolis at the Hubert H. Humphrey Institute on the 50th anniversary of the late Senator Humphrey's magnificent address at the Democratic National Convention in 1948. That's when he made his famous "Let's come out of the darkness into the sunshine on human rights," and it actually was a decisive moment in turning American politics. So I was invited to come out to the Hubert H. Humphrey Institute at the university there, and speak on the occasion of the 50th anniversary. And that's, Hubert Humphrey was a mentor to me. He was one of my first political teachers when I went to Washington, a man I worked very closely with in establishing the Peace Corps in the Civil Rights Act of 64 and 65, and when he was vice president. And he was a great soul and a great figure, although he's passing from memory now. And that speech is one of my favorites.
Let me go to the phones to Jane in St. Paul. Hi, Jane. Thanks so much for waiting. Your question.
Yes, good morning. Mr. Moyers, I wanted to just have you to please tell the public, I wish you would tell the public, but I wish someone would also tell Barack that the business of wearing one's flag pin on the lapel, I loved at the time that you made the comment that you don't have to wear your mother's photo on your lapel in order to tell her you love her. So I wish that he'd remember that. I'm also an African-American who very much appreciates the comments that you just made regarding Reverend Wright. I think that something that's been going on here is that we've tended to have pundits who really see all of us as monolithic. And an argument that I've had for possibly 40 years is that they also tend to act as though we have specific leaders, but they don't have to have specific leaders when it comes to the Caucasian population. And I always find that very interesting that they see us as following, like, you know, some animals off of a cliff and jumping into whatever it is. Barack is part of our family. He is our brother. He is our husband. He is our son. He's in a number of things to a number of African Americans, and I find it very curious, since I happen, by the way, to be a Hillary supporter, I find it very curious that there have been any number of people who have been really saying some terrible things lately about how the African Americans are not going to follow Hillary if she had made it, and I don't think she's going to, frankly, but they would say that kind of thing without any hesitation. At the same time, they also have very willingly allowed public policy or public opinion to assume that it's okay that we have maybe 90% of the African-American public voting for Barack, and not understanding, of course. I loved it when Bill Clinton was in Georgia just 2 days before the elections there, and he was talking to a black congregation, and I actually had members of my family from other cities to call me and comment on it, because they adore the Clintons. They adore Bill Clinton, absolutely, but they're voting for Barack.
Jane?
And so one of them called, and this is, I'll say, one of them said, did you see Clinton when he spoke to the black congregation, and he said, all my life I've waited for a black to run for office, and I waited for a woman to run for office, and I think the Lord is now trying to mess with my mind. I'll hang up on that. But
good to have your call.
Would you speak to that?
Well, I was listening so intently that I'm not sure I can speak to any particular. Let me just say this. It's totally understandable why the African-American community would vote for the very first African-American to have a serious shot at the presidency. I mean, Lyndon Johnson, when we passed the Civil Rights Act in 1964, and I was there at his side with Hubert Humphrey and others, Lyndon Johnson said, you know, boys, as he referred to all of us, he said, what we've just done today is to make it possible for one of those young men who didn't make it to college, who didn't make it to public office, who didn't get a good job because of race segregation. One of them will be sitting right here one day, and what we just did today it will be seen as the catalyst. I think that's true. Whether it's Obama or not, we don't know yet. There's still several months to go. But I can understand African Americans who want to see one of their own finally make it. I can understand women who feel that that sisterly bond with Hillary Clinton, because we've never had an African American president and we've never had a woman president. This has been a magnificent moment in American democracy for that. But it's also at the same time created some very dramatic, even tragic choices, because if you are an African American woman, and you want to identify with each of the candidates, it makes a very difficult, Solomon-like choice you're going to have to make. But, Jane, your point was exactly right. I'm many people. You're many people. And to be judged only by our identity, by our gender or by our color, is unfair to the complexities of our persona, of our personality, of our experience. So I do think that I did a commentary. I do Bill Moyer's journal every Friday night on KCTA there in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And I ended my commentary the week after the Jeremiah Wright interview by quoting the great Swiss historian Jacob Burckhardt, who said, "Beware the terrible simplifiers." And that carries, you asked me earlier about the press, that's the main, that's the calamity of American media today, is that it thrives on simplicities.
I want to come back to that question, though, that you asked Wright, that I'm curious what your thoughts are. And that goes to the identity of how we see ourselves as Americans, that question that we really don't want to acknowledge, that we're a country capable of greatness but also capable of cruelty. It's a very sensitive thing to talk about. Why?
Because so many people are ahistorical. They don't remember what was done to the indigenous people by the Europeans arriving here 340 years ago. They don't want to remember that for 350 years we tolerated slavery, and even then it took a bloody civil war to end slavery. And then after the Civil War, it took 100 years of segregation and finally the Civil Rights Movement before African Americans were accorded the rights that had been won on the battlefield in the Civil War. We don't like to talk about what was done to the Native. Right now I'm reading Louise Erdrich's new novel.
Oh, good for you. She was just here. Oh, it's a great book. Yes.
It is a great book. And, you know, you can't read it without being reminded of the cruelties inflicted, first of all, by Native Americans upon each other, and then by white Americans upon Native Americans. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just to look, to be, so many people confuse the government with the country and an administration with the government. But the country is bigger than the Bush administration, and the Bush administration is not the whole of the government. And the right to criticize our political administrations, our government, is not the same as hating America. The right has succeeded. The right wing, the radical right, Fox News and others have succeeded in making it appear that any criticism of the government is criticism of America, which is an astonishing triumph when you come to think about it, because when the Democrats or the liberals were running the government, they were always criticizing the administrations. But now when they've been in power for 8 years, when you criticize them, they say you're unpatriotic. It's a big lie that they have promoted and have been getting away with them. But to me, the most American of all mindsets is the critical faculty. It's the question and challenge. That's what the First Amendment is all about. With all power, I don't care who has it, all power is guilty of being wrong at times, because groupthink will lead you astray. And so the right to speak up, the right of dissent, is the most fundamental of American values, in my judgment.
Let me take a call from Conrad in Moorhead. Thanks so much for waiting your question.
Yes, thank you. Regarding President Lyndon Baines Johnson, Mr. Moyers, may I ask, will you kindly summarize his contribution to democracy and perhaps speculate as to how he might evaluate the current state of our American democracy? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that question. Lyndon Johnson was 13 of the most interesting people I ever met. He could be magnanimous. He could be petty. He could be generous, and he could be a tightwad. He was the best dancer in the White House since George Washington, but he could be clumsy in his personal behaviors as well. He was a very complicated man. But very quickly, since we're running out of time, I think he will be seen as the right man in the right place at the right moment when the civil rights movement needed a president who was responsive to the moral and or political claims of justice for African Americans. He will be remembered as the man who led us into one of the most costly quagmires in American history, which was Vietnam. And one of the reasons I was so opposed to the war on Iraq when it began is because I could see this Bush administration making the same mistakes the Johnson administration made 40 years ago. And I think that Lyndon Johnson will always be judged in the frame of both Vietnam and his domestic policies, which were meant to make America, to share the prosperity of America with everyone.
We talk about history fairly often on the program. We just did a show last week on the Declaration of Independence, and I got a kick out of reading your speech to the Texas Historical Society 10 years or so ago, where
right.
you talked about the historical figures that you would have loved to have interviewed. You zeroed in on Sylvia King. What an interesting story.
That's one of my favorite speeches. You know, I grew up in Texas, and I never learned anything about slavery. I never learned anything about black people. I never learned anything about Mexicans, because all of my teachers, who were great teachers of English and great teachers of math and people like that, they taught a one-sided view of history. We didn't know that there were African Americans who had arrived in Texas a long time ago and took part in building the state. You can read in the book little paragraphs about some of those, including Susan King, whom I never discovered until I went actually to speak to the Texas State Historical Society and did some deep research into other people in history that I hadn't learned about when I was growing up in the schools of Marshall, Texas, or even at the University of Texas. One of the things I like about the Hubert Humphrey speech I gave at the memorial to Hubert Humphrey was because I am able to remind people, of the other people who were left out of the story when we were fighting for civil rights, what was going on in Mississippi and places like that. I mean, I do truly believe that history is one of the best teachers about current affairs that we have, and that's why in my book you'll find three speeches I made about history.
Do you still end your day, as you once said, watching John Stewart?
I think yes,
Do you? I think you referred to him as Mark Twain is alive and well on Comedy Central.
Yeah, there's so much that you can say through humor about reality that you can't say head on. Because for one of the things we were talking earlier about how people don't want to be critical. They don't want to hear their politician or their country criticized. No, I said on John Stewart, and by the way, I'll be on John Stewart tomorrow night.
Oh, good.
As he was on my show, when I came back on the air with Bill Moyers Journal, he was my first guest. Because I really do believe that satire, that humor, can get at the truth that you can't get in what I call ordinary prose. So I do think that if Mark Twain were back today, he would be on Comedy Central.
What does that satire tell us about our democracy that can't be said in other forums? Why does that work?
Because of our partisanship and our ideologies, we don't like to be hit head on with criticism of our position, our ideas, or our politicians. But it goes down much easier when everybody's laughing and you can then see the absurdity of even your own position. I mean, I think that it's just that humor is a stiletto, whereas a criticism is a machete.
I'm a fan of Stephen Colbert's. Do you watch his show too?
I do, but it comes on 11:30 here, and a straight hour from 11 to 12 every night is a little bit more for a man at my age and stage.
And I do want to tell you that your son Cope was with us when his book Broken came out over a year or so ago. And when he was here, he talked to us about this letter that you'd written to him after he decided to move to St. Paul. And you expressed your concerns about that decision. And in the letter, you told him that he'd done the right thing. And he writes in the book, of all the letters Dad had written to me over the years, this one touched my heart most deeply. Do you still hear from people who have read that book and the story of his addiction and what the family went through that will tell you that it was meaningful to know what happened?
It's been a great source of joy and pride to me that when I'm stopped on the street, which I am, because those of us on television become intimate strangers to everyone else, more people today want to talk about my son than want to talk about me.
Is that right?
Yes, they've read the book Broken. They've heard him speak. They know he's a powerful witness to what Minnesotans have known for a long time, is that addiction can be treated and recovery is possible. He's become, yes, the son has surpassed the father, which I think is a very good thing. You know, we come out to St. Paul quite often. We have those, our son and his wife, Allison, and our three grandchildren live there. And when I first started coming out many years ago, people would stop and talk about my programs. But now they stop and talk about his book. And that's that's good. By the way, I will be there on June the 7th speaking to the 4th Annual Media Reform Conference sponsored by the organization Free Press. And I'll be speaking on Saturday morning, June 7th, after which I'll be signing books. So I hope to see a lot of your listeners there.
I hope the next time that you come to St. Paul, I know you're busy when you come in June, but how about the next time that you come into the studio and we'll talk in person? Could we do that?
We will. I'll be out there only on the weekend. I always try to hold my time for the family, you know, but one thing we do when we're there, Carrie, and I'm not exaggerating, I'm not flattering you, you have such a good, intelligent broadcast that we always try to make sure we're having our second cup of coffee after William Cope has gone to work and the kids have gone to school, so that we can listen to your broadcast.
Oh, come on.
No, that's
really
the truth.
Oh,
my wife,
gosh.
Judith Morris, who's never told a lie, like George Washington, testifies to that.
You have made my week. Thank you. Thanks so much for being with us. I really appreciate it. Come back.
Okay.
Bill Moyers with us this morning from New York. We talked about his newest book, Moyers on Democracy. It's a collection of speeches, eulogies, reflections that he's given over the course of the years on this theme of democracy. At 10, we are just a couple of minutes here. We are talking about the GI Bill that Congress is debating. Interesting divisions arising in this bill. The Pentagon, the White House, they don't like the cost of the bill, but they're also concerned that the education benefits, basically a four-year deal of tuition and living expenses at a public college. White House, the military, the Pentagon concerned that the education benefits are too generous and it will cause people to get out of the service too early. So we'll talk about that. That's coming up at 10. If there are veterans listening to our conversation, I'll be real curious to hear your perspective on this. Tomorrow, two great discussions at 9. Well, you heard Bill Moyers and I talking about the influence of money on politics. We're going to dig into that. We're going to talk about how the candidates are raising money, so much of it coming in online, much of it coming from smaller donors, how that may change the way government gets done. Will it? I think Bill Moyers said 6 months after the election, the voters realize that things are back to normal and nothing has really changed. Well, this time around, is that going to be the case? We'll talk about that tomorrow morning at 9. And then at 10, this is a conversation I've really been looking forward to. Paleontologist Neil Shubin is going to be with us. He's out with a new book called Your Inner Fish. But the story behind this book is fascinating. A few years ago, he went up to Ellesmere Island in the Arctic. He was up there with a team, and they discovered a fossil that makes the link, that bridges the link between life that lived in the water and life that moved up on land. There are photographs in the book of this fossil, this creature, and he is about to go back to Ellesmere Island to look for more fossils. Now he's looking for fossils of creatures, amphibious creatures that actually had fingers. We'll talk about why he's after that. This will be a fun conversation. As you know, we like to delve into science on Mid-Morning. Neil Shubin with us tomorrow morning from Chicago. By the way, he's head of the department at the Field Museum in Chicago. So listen in for that. This is Mid-Morning.
Support for this program comes from the Bush Foundation's Leadership Fellows Program, supporting leaders at mid-career, giving time for learning, inspiration, and reflection, helping reach their goals and strengthen their communities. Twin Cities meetings May 19th and 20th. BushFoundation.org.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio 91.1 FM KXLC La Crescent.